2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 351, Claimed by the Rush of Red Water, a paper presented by Judith Freeman.
Are there any questions on this? Okay. I'd like to welcome all of you here. Invite you to move forward if you'd like to. There are about five other sessions almost as interesting as this one's going to be. And so there's a lot of competition for all of these sessions. But actually, you've chosen the right one. So if you're comfortable moving forward, then I think it makes our speaker feel like she's not in such a huge cavern. You know, we're really very privileged to have Judith Freeman with us today. She's a novelist who's been very well received nationally and locally since The Chinchilla Farm came out in 1989, and her books have received a number of awards. It's not until her most recent book, however, that the historians have really gone after her. And so I think that the Redwater following The Chinchilla Farm, Set for Life, A Desert of Pure Feeling, Family Attractions, has made people take notice in a way that perhaps they hadn't before. And I've listened to Judith speak before. I know that she did meticulous research for this book, aided by a Guggenheim Fellowship, which of course is not only a very helpful but a very prestigious aid for anyone who's doing research. And so I thought I'd offer just a minute's history on the idea of history and fiction. Long ago, in fact, before the Sunstone Symposium was invented, I remember a group of historians from the LDS Church Historical Department meeting at our home in Sugar House to talk about what was then thought to be the best Mormon novel about Southern Utah by Maureen Whipple, the name of which has just gone right out of my head, The Giant Joshua. And you might wonder why historians were talking about this novel. Well, they were talking about whether it was good history or not. And as I remember, the upshot of the conversation was that it was not. And I don't actually remember a group of novelists gathering to talk about whether a book of history was good. Well, they could talk about whether it was good writing, perhaps, whether or not it was good fiction. But I have had experiences that come close to that. Only a decade later, I can remember, and some of you may have had the same experience, going to talk to groups about my fiction and having them just about refuse to believe that I had not actually, you know, been abandoned by my husband, opened a nursery school, had an affair with a Navajo football coach, whatever, you know. I mean, seriously, they would look me in the eye and say, no, this must have happened to you. And there are strengths in both history and fiction. They're different strengths. The strength of history, or journalism for that matter, is that you're putting your name on something and saying, this really happened. And my research will stand up to that. Let the lawsuits, let the critics, let whoever come, this really happened. And the strength of fiction is going inside that story and creating those characters and voices and the plot so convincingly that people say, yes, this really happened. And I know how I feel it happening. I know how it happened. The trick of it, of course, is that sometimes you have to write fiction in order to really tell the truth. And both historians and novelists know this. And I think that those of us who have read Redwater or who are about to read that book are fortunate indeed that Judith Freeman walked into one of the darkest areas of Mormon history and then went to the least heard voices, which of course are women's, whether you're looking at history or scripture or corporate minutes or whatever, and let those voices speak in ways that will change those of us who have read that book. And I think both Mormon fiction and history forever. Please welcome Judith Freeman.
Well, I want to thank Linda for that introduction. I've known of her and known her and her husband John for a number of years, and admire their work, what they do as librarians, as writers, as thinkers. And it's very interesting for me to be here today. I don't know whether I thought that I would ever end up at Sunstone. I don't even know how much I know about Sunstone. But I thank Dan Witherspoon and John Hatch and the people who organized this conference and who invited me to be here. In the end, I think it's very important to be among and with your own people. And as estranged as I might have become from the Mormon Church over the years, I always feel a connection and appreciate that connection. And I think I appreciate it and connect to it in a different way after writing this particular novel, which for me was a life-changing experience. There's no question about it. There are many things I want to talk about today, but I also want to leave time to answer questions if you have any. And I really am glad that Linda introduced me the way she did, because she touched on one of the things that I want to talk about, which is the connection and the relationship between truth and fiction, history and fiction, the kinds of stories that we tell ourselves, how they shape our existence, why it's very important to examine those stories. Okay. Let's see. Is that any better? Can you hear me? There's also one other thing that I would like to say, and that is I'm thinking very much today of a woman named Dr. Neela Sesachari, who was a friend of mine who died last year. She was a great, affectionate supporter of Sunstone and culture, even though she herself was a Hindu. I miss her so much, and I know that if she were still alive, she would be here today. So this talk is for Neela. And also for my parents, Roy and Alice Freeman, who are not here either. They died over a decade ago, and they were really remarkable people. And I was thinking today when I came here, it would have been so nice to have them here in the audience. I think it would have been. What I want to talk about today in part is fear and revenge. And I believe that Mormons have a rather skewed view of our own history. And this is not an accident or due to simple ignorance on our part. This is a result of an orchestrated attempt to prettify the past, to obscure events and facts, to deify certain people, and to vilify or demonize other people. Our history, like most histories, has been made into a fiction. What, I wondered, would happen if I used fiction to try and reconstruct a truer sense of history? I believed it might be possible. Now I'm going to go back. That's the only thing that I really prepared to say to you, is that I have come to realize what a fiction history is and how really it is distorted to serve the purposes of the people who continue to want to shape the story that they'd like to put forth. I'm going to talk specifically about how I came to write Redwater. I had written three novels and a collection of short stories, some of which were about growing up in the Mormon culture and in Utah, but many of which had nothing to do with that. They were set in Guatemala. They were set on a boat going across the ocean. They were set in Australia. They were about a variety of things, all having to do with how human beings work out their relationship and existence. And I was in a bookstore. I had just finished a book called A Desert of Pure Feeling, and it had come out, and I was in a bookstore in Port Townsend, Washington, and I picked up a book called The Mountain Meadows Massacre by Juanita Brooks in a used bookstore. And I just looked at the cover very quickly and read the blurbs and thought, wow, I'm going to buy this book. And I bought it, and I read it, and I was astonished. Because I had grown up in Ogden, Utah, in a large Mormon family. And although I remember hearing some vague rumor about a massacre in southern Utah committed by Mormons, but really it was about Indians. The Indians did it. And really it was because these people deserved it somehow. And it was an unfortunate thing, but it was just like this gray cloud of a story, shapeless and undefined, that had to do with the Mountain Meadows Massacre. So that when I actually read Juanita Brooks's book, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, which is still an extraordinary book, a kind of seminal history of that event, the first person to ever really try and strip away the lies and the deceits and to tell the truth about this event, I was astonished. And I was astonished because I could have grown up in this culture. And that story could have been so successfully hidden and enfolded into some other version of our own history, so obscured. And really, the question that I set out to answer, and that book claimed me. It's true, I was, as Dan Witherspoon put in his description, I was claimed. People think writers decide what they're going to write about. But very often that subject matter just claims you. It insists that you will write this story. And that's what happened to me with Redwater. I read this book, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, and I knew I had to write a novel about this subject matter. Even though I'm not a historian, I'm a self-taught writer. I have no degrees. I barely knew how to use a library. I knew it would be an enormous amount of research. I had no wish or ever thought I would write a historical novel. I was completely daunted by the thought of doing that. But I had to do it. And I later asked myself, well, why did you have to do it? What was it about the story? And there were really two things, two very important things. And one was, I wanted to try and answer the question, how do you get basically really, really good people, really decent people, to commit such evil? I know the Mormon people. I know how decent they are as a people, and by and large. I know how my own ancestors, from what I understand, I know that's slightly mythologized, as it is for all of us, but I know they were good people. I know they were really decent people. They could have been part of the people who committed that massacre. They weren't, but they could have been. There were 70 to 100 Mormons, men and boys, who were there that day, who took part in the killing of women and children, of men. 70 women, children, more women and children than men. How do you get good, decent people to commit that kind of evil? I wanted to know. And because I come from this culture, I also wanted to try, as I said, what if you were to try and use fiction to reconstruct a truer sense of history? And I happen to feel that novels, as documents, that they often are read by people as a truer sense of history of that particular time than even history is often read. I think we get our sense of history quite a bit from fiction, in fact. And I don't think that's misguided. I think sometimes novels give a very clear picture of the time in which they were written. And I decided that I was really going to strive for a kind of fundamental accuracy. Yes, I would be telling one great big fabrication. I would be writing a novel. But it was very important to me that I got those incremental facts right. I spent 5.5 years, 6 years, writing and researching Redwater. Much longer than any other novel. Usually a novel takes me a year to write and a year to rewrite. But when I started on this project, I think I knew that I was going down an incredibly difficult road, that I would have to try and familiarize myself with a period that I really hadn't thought much about before. And so I started reading, and I went to the Huntington Library, and I got a reader's card, and they have an extraordinary collection of 19th century Mormon documents. And I went to the Utah State Historical Society, and they were very helpful there. Will Bagley was incredibly helpful to me. Floyd O'Neill, Gregory Thompson. These three historians came together and took me to lunch when I started this project. And Floyd O'Neill looked at me and said, "You're going to write a novel about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Oh, Lord, I wish you well." "Oh, Lordy, Lordy, Lordy," he said. I just want to tell you that anyone that's ever tried to tackle this subject matter, as far as I know, has failed. I said, "Gee, Floyd, thanks a lot." But Will Bagley arrived that day with some papers for me, and he handed me a document. And it turned out to be one of the most remarkable documents that I worked with to write this book, and it was called My Life with a Saintly Devil by Anne Gorge Lee. And it was a document that had been buried for years in a shoebox in somebody's closet. It was still curled up when Will found it in, I think, an archive at BYU and took it out and Xeroxed it. And it was being privately circulated among some historians, including Patty Nelson Limerick and other people who were saying, "Wow, what an extraordinary document." Anne Gorge Lee was John D. Lee's 19th wife. She was 13 years old when he married her. He was 56. She had three children by him, and then after he was excommunicated and went into his last hiding place at Lee's Ferry, she bolted. She left those three children with the other wives, one with her brother, two with her sister wife, Emma. She began dressing as a man and making her way in the world, cross-dressing. She rode down into Mexico with a band of Indians. Supposedly she lived in a convent there for a while and converted to Catholicism. She came back and went into Montana. And perhaps she worked in mining towns as a laundress, which was often a code word for another kind of profession. She later bought a ranch in Oregon. She ranched in Idaho. She had an extraordinary life. And at the end of her life, in the early 1900s, she turned up in Salt Lake City, penniless. She was living in an apartment building, in an apartment completely poverty-stricken, and started to write this memoir, My Life with a Saintly Devil. Because John D. Lee in his time was like, who could we compare him to? He was incredibly famous. He was so notorious. He was in all the newspapers. He had become a celebrity even after his death. And so I think Anne Gorge Lee thought that she might make a little bit of money if she wrote this memoir about her life with John D. Lee. Of course, she didn't. She ended up giving it to a policeman who came to her aid because she was starving and brought her some food, and then she disappeared. We have no idea when Anne Gorge Lee died, where she died, where she was buried. But here in 1996 turns up this document, My Life with a Saintly Devil. It had extraordinary stories in it, some of which I really believe were fantastic, that she embellished them in order to create a narrative that she thought might be more salacious or appealing. Some of those stories, though, sounded absolutely true to me, and they were remarkable stories. So Anne Gorge Lee became, for me, a really important voice. And when I started out to write this book, you cannot write about Mountain Meadows without writing about John D. Lee, who was at the center of it all, the only man ever arrested and executed for his part in the crime. There's no question but what he was set up, and there's no question but what he became a scapegoat for his people so that they could go on. But when I thought about writing this novel, I knew that I didn't want to write about the massacre per se. I knew that I didn't want to write about John D. Lee from the point of John D. Lee, and it became clear to me from very early on, I'm going to tell this story about the massacre, about early Mormon settlement, about John D. Lee, by taking three of his wives, each of whom had a very different relationship with him, and I'm going to tell the story from their perspective. And in a sense, you get that kind of Rashomon effect, where you get the view of one man from three perspectives, each of whom had very different feelings about this man. And so I chose not only Ann Gorge Lee because I had this incredible document that she wrote at the end of her life. I chose Emma Lee because she was the only English woman that John D. Lee had ever married, and because Juanita Brooks had also written a wonderful little biography of Emma Lee. And there were so many rich facts. There was so much rich information about Emma, and she was an enormously appealing character. She was so strong that if a man offended her, she had no hesitation about taking her buggy whip and giving him a good whack along the side of the head. She was an incredibly strong woman. And then the third narrator, the third narrator I chose, was one of John D. Lee's first wives, Rachel, who was the sister of Agatha, who was John D. Lee's first wife. He married Rachel second, I think. He ended up also marrying another one of their sisters and their widowed mother. So all in all, he was married to three sisters and their mother at one point. The mother died crossing the plains. He said he really married her just for her spiritual sake. So these three women provided me with the voices that I felt I needed to tell my story. And in fact, they became so intimate and so insinuated in my life that in the morning when I would get up and go upstairs to my room to begin writing, it really was as though I sat down in that world, in their company, with their voices, with their presence. So even though Redwater is a novel and it's a great fictional construction, I worked so hard to get the history right. Why not? I mean, why make up things that in fact you can discover that are so rich and so real and so loaded with potential to give rise to story? I couldn't imagine the things that I discovered. I could have never begun to imagine these things. So I read for 3 years. And then I went to Rome for a year because my husband, who's an artist, got a Rome Prize, and we went to the American Academy to live. And for a year, I sat in a villa at the American Academy in Rome and tried to write a novel about the American West. While looking out over the rooftops of Rome, it was difficult. I missed my landscape. I missed my West. But in one way, what it also did is that each afternoon when I finished writing, I would go out walking in Rome and I would visit some of my favorite churches and I would look at paintings by Caravaggio or by Bernini or Bellini or any one of a number of other extraordinary painters, and what I would see was the bloody history of Christianity portrayed in remarkable art. So in one way I was very divorced from my subject matter, but in another way what I really was looking at was the history of religion in art. And what I was coming to realize was that my own religion had a bloodier history than I ever could have imagined. That's not something I think we should run from, and that's not something I think we should deny. That's something I think we should understand. And I feel like in writing a novel about Redwater, about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, about early Mormon settlement, about the struggle of those Mormons to maintain the viability of their community and their relationship in the face of a potential war with the United States, more persecution. I just came to have such respect for those people, many of whom ended up being my own ancestors. The more I researched, the more I came across the names of my ancestors, all of whom knew John D. Lee, all of whom crossed the Colorado, or many of whom crossed the Colorado on ferries piloted by John D. Lee, because they were called by Brigham Young to settle in Arizona. One of the most interesting things I discovered as I began to really, the further I got into the research, is that I discovered that my own great-great-grandfather was a man named Dimmick Huntington. I think I knew this, but I hadn't been that interested in genealogy. But I discovered that Dimmick Huntington, my mother's great-grandfather, was Brigham Young's Indian interpreter. He was also the first man to attempt to write a dictionary of the Paiute language. He was a remarkable man, but even more remarkable is that the diary of Dimmick Huntington provides us with some of the strongest evidence that we have that the Mountain Meadows Massacre, the events that led up to that unfathomably tragic event, were set in motion at the highest levels of the church. My own great-great-grandfather, his diary gives us entries shortly before the massacre occurred on September 11th, 1857. Here are some of the entries from his diaries. September 1st. Antero came to see the president, and Brigham told him to be at peace with all men except the Americans, and when an Indian stole from another, not to be mad with anyone else, but that one that stole from him, and when a Ute stole from the snakes, give up that man that stole to the snakes, and let them have with him as they might. September 8th. Powder, the Goshute, came to see us, and he was told the same. This is from August 30th, so we're talking about 10, 11 days before the massacre. I told them that the Lord had come out of his hiding place, and they had to commence their work. These are the Indian chiefs that he's called together, that Brigham has called to Salt Lake City. I gave them all the beef cattle and horses that was on the route to California. Arpine came to see Brigham. Brigham told him now is the time to help himself to what he wanted. We must work that God and the prophet had said they must. You see, we must do the work that God and the prophets had said they must do. And Joseph's blood had got to be avenged, and they had got to help do it. Incredible. The question that I ask is, does it matter? And I'm not here to assign blame, but this is a question to consider. Does it matter that the authorities of the church set up the Indians to commit that massacre, or that they set up the whites to commit that massacre? Isn't it still murder, and isn't there complicity? The question that I said that I set out to answer in this book was, how do you get good men to commit such terrible evil? And I think that there are three things that you have to do. And the first thing that you do, and think of this carefully in the world that we live in now, because I really am talking about fear and revenge and what people do in the name of God and belief. The first thing that you need to do is to elicit from people perfect obedience. Perfect obedience. And the second thing that you need to do is that you need to make them feel that they are threatened and that their way of life is threatened. In other words, you crank up the fear and you make them think that it's them or us. And the third thing that you need to do is make them believe that they're doing God's will, that what they're doing has a higher purpose than what anyone else is doing. And if you can do those three things, if you can extract from people perfect obedience, a sense of obedience, whether that's to a notion of whatever, country, God, family, clan, and you can instill fear, and you can make people believe that God is on their side, you can get them to do anything. I'm convinced of that. In the end, I think that I came to have such an appreciation for Mormon culture, for the people I come from. I think it's unfortunate that those people who committed the massacre, who were really ordered to do it by their superiors in the Iron County Militia, that those people's lives were destroyed forever. That in 1857, in the years following the massacre, Cedar City had been a thriving community, as had a number of other small communities around there. Within a year, two or three, Cedar City was almost emptied out. The sense of shame that descended on those people was so overwhelming and overpowering that the most of them wanted to leave. They were also afraid that the federal authorities would come after them. And many of them fled. They fled to the Big Muddy. They fled to Las Vegas Springs. They fled to San Bernardino, and they fled to Nevada. They got out of there. The land was tainted. And for those of you who have ever visited Mountain Meadows, it's a haunted, haunted place. So here we have what really is the darkest, saddest episode in Mormon history. And in writing this book, I felt at times like I was descending into hell. I went personally through some of the most difficult things that I've ever gone through in my life. And there was a point at which I was spending a spring alone in we have a little house in Idaho, and my husband was in LA. I determined to stay there alone throughout the spring and ride. And I would ride in the morning, and I would go out in the afternoon and cross-country ski with my dog, almost to try and expunge what I had been feeling earlier when I was riding. And I became so upset that spring. It seemed there was war everywhere in the world. It seemed there was terror, and this was before September 11th. It seemed like every tribe in Africa was at each other's throat. Children were getting their limbs hacked off. Elephants were disappearing from the world. The sense of discord and unpeace overwhelmed me. And I felt like I crawled up to some edge and peered over. And it had to do with this feeling that I had of how can humans be so violent to each other and to the world, to the earth, to the species. And I really lost a sense of perspective. It was really like crawling up to the edge and looking over the edge. And then I crawled back. And then I finished the book. And those women sustained me. I cannot tell you the affection that I feel for John D. Lee's wives, especially those I came to know. How remarkable I thought they were. I wanted to write about women on the frontier, and I did. And they were so incredible. And I came to have a lot of respect for John D. Lee, too. Very complex man, perfect man for fiction. Equal parts good and evil. But he took the bullet for his church, and he did enable those people to go on. The heat was off. The heat was off Brigham. The heat was off the leaders. There was no will to continue to try and find the people who had been involved in the massacre. The Mormons began making conciliations to the federal government. They went on. John D. Lee really helped his people enormously. But what happened was he was so vilified and so demonized, and Brigham Young was so deified, that both men have come down to us as slightly unreal. And what I wanted to do in Red Water, because they were really quite similar, those two men. They had more in common than you would think. They were both remarkable frontiersmen. They were both completely devoted to their church. They would have done anything for it. I wanted to make both men slightly more human. Whether I did that is really up to you to decide. Chekhov once said that drawing conclusions is up to the jury, that is, the readers. My own job is to be talented, to know how to distinguish the important testimony from unimportant, and to place my characters in the proper light and speak their language. And that's really what I tried to do in Red Water. I tried to place those characters in the proper light, and I tried to speak their language. And I feel like that book was a gift. I'll always be grateful for it, that I got it, finally, after all that time, and after crawling up to that edge, and after feeling a great deal of anguish, both for the people who were massacred there. Overwhelmingly sad. And for the people who did the massacring, because they were victims too. And their families bore the brunt of those crimes for generations. One of Lavinia's great-great-granddaughters is here today. Lavinia was one of John D. Lee's wives, and she came to the book signing just a little while ago and said, you know, nobody in my family wanted to claim John D. Lee. And, you know, that was the story for John D. Lee's descendants. Emily, one of her daughters, committed suicide, a 13-year-old girl in Winslow. Emma, after John D. Lee was executed, remarried a man named Frank French and went to live in Winslow, and she became a doctor there, a remarkable woman. Dr. French. She helped so many people in that community. But not long after she'd moved there, one of her daughters killed herself, simply because, I believe, the sense of enmity toward all those descendants of John D. Lee was so great. That girl was so humiliated that she couldn't live among her peers. That is the story of John D. Lee for generations. It wasn't fair. I mean, things aren't fair so often. But it wasn't just John D. Lee. It was many of those people in southern Utah who were descendants of the people who took part in the massacre. They feel doubly offended when they hear the president of the church say, as he did a few years ago when the new monument was dedicated, when he was asked, and I'm talking about Gordon Hinckley, who should we blame for this massacre? Who's responsible? And he said, well, it was a very tragic thing, but it was the work of a group of local fanatics. We had nothing to do with it. It's still an insult to those people who lived in southern Utah, who were descended from those people who did their religious duty when they were called upon by their superiors to do it. So I suppose, thinking about my father, who was a wonderful man, a liberal, a guy who wore an ERA button on his lapel in the 70s because he really believed in the Equal Rights Amendment. Most people thought it had to do with baseball, I'm sure. But he was always for the little guy. He was a Democrat in a ward full of Republicans. He was a thinker. He never got beyond high school, but he had great ideas. And our dinner table was always a place where we debated things and we talked about things. So So I really think, you know, I'm the child of the father, and that Red Water, in a sense, is also a book that champions the little guy. And that it hasn't always. Even though we call it the divine principle, from the time I was little, I was used to sit around and think, how did that work? You know. And after Red Water was published, I had no idea what kind of reaction it would get in Utah, and I'm very grateful that it won the Utah Book Award. I'm very grateful that ordinary Mormons, that people have embraced the book. I think people are relieved to have a greater truth told. I think it frees us to go on and be even stronger people. Lies are what make us weak and really vulnerable. But somebody said to me, you know, I heard someone say that they really liked the book. The only thing that was bothering people, some people in Utah who were reading it, was the sex in the book. And I said, the sex and not the massacre? Amazing. So anyway, it's I'd be happy to answer any questions if anybody has any about the writing of the book or whatever. Yeah, go ahead.
I just read the book in the last 2 weeks. And was deeply affected by it. I asked a friend of mine, Lawyer Jarvis, about a specific thing that Anne Burns said in a letter in the novel, suggesting that John D. Lee took a character named Uncle John out and saved his soul, so to speak. And I asked Lawyer about that. He said there was a book written by Juanita Brooks called Emma Lee that alludes to that. And I read Emma Lee just last week and enjoyed it thoroughly. If it was there, I missed it.
It's there. Wait a minute. I think it's there.
I missed it. It may be somewhere else. Or either that or I turned 2 pages.
Yeah. Now I'm not sure.
Can you talk about? I mean, there is the massacre. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about John D. Lee, the historicity of John D. Lee doing that other thing that was like the massacre?
Mm-hmm. He's referring to an event that either Anne Gorge Lee writes about in her diary or Juanita Brooks writes about in her biography of Emily, in which after the massacre, you know, John D. Lee prospered in the wake of that massacre. That was a very rich wagon train, and he got a lot of the loot. He got a lot of the cattle. It was really divvied up, but he got the lion's share. He was a wealthy man. He had houses in Tocqueville and Washington and Canara and you know, Harmony, and he had wives everywhere, and he had industries, and he lived brazenly and openly because he believed that Brigham, who had adopted him as his spiritual son, would continue to protect him. And the story is that there was a man who came and worked for him for a summer, and then they had a falling out, and the man wanted to leave, and John D. Lee paid him off in horses, but he really didn't want to give him those horses. John D. Lee was a tightwad. He was a bad businessman. He could cheat somebody in the blink of an eye if he wanted to. He could be generous on the other hand, but he didn't want to give Uncle John, this worker who wanted to take off with his pay for the work. But he said, okay, here's your horses, and then he said, I'll tell you what, I'll even help you. I'll ride you out and show you where you can camp, and I'll help you get your horses on the road safely. And the next morning, the man turned up dead. And Anne Gorge Lee reports, this is her story, that she had a dream that night, and that he came home before she had this dream. He came home and he was wearing his buckskin, he put on his buckskin suit. Mormons in southern Utah in the 19th century dressed as Indians often. And as Anne Gorge Lee said, much mischief was gotten up this way. And they would paint their faces red, and they would do what they needed to do, what they felt they needed to do, to keep the sanctity of their communities and to punish people and to whatever. So the story goes is that he put on his buckskin suit after showing John, Uncle John, out of town and got him all camped safely and murdered him, dressed as an Indian. And that Anne Gorge Lee went out the next day and found that buckskin suit stuffed in some rocks not far from where the man had been murdered. And she knew then that John D. Lee had done it. And she said she left him not long afterwards because she thought he was a man capable of anything. And she began to fear for her own life. You have to take her stories with a grain of salt. But one of the things I had to decide was, do I think that this man was capable of murder? Yes. And they had a term for it in those days, and it was called holy murder. You could justify murdering someone. And it wasn't just about blood atonement. It was about the greater good of the community. And I came to believe that he was capable of murder, and that he had committed murders at the Meadow. Yeah.
One of the details that I thought was the most horrifying and the most convincing was the women and, well, everyone wearing the bloodstained shoes and clothing of the one thing that it did was it showed the poverty, and I thought that wrenching poverty was as much a factor maybe as the other things that you've listed. Mm-hmm. There's something so brutal about that poverty, mm-hmm. that people could wear bloodstained clothing and fight over it. Mm-hmm. That to me was one of the most horrifying things, and I'm wondering how you came to write that detail. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Well, it was true. They were so poor. We have no idea how poor those people were. There was nothing, especially in those southern communities. Mormonism was a very class-ridden society. I hadn't realized that. The guys in the north were the elite. There were many wealthy families. It was a real class-ridden society. And the people on the bottom were those poor settlers in the south, and they had nothing. If you could carve a wooden bowl and two forks, if you could get the leather to make a pair of shoes, you were lucky. And here came this rich wagon train. And they stripped those bodies. Some of the women went out to the meadow the next morning, and they took everything off those dead people and those dead children, and they put it in the bishop's storehouse in Cedar City, and you could go there and get shoes and clothing for your children, and you needed it. And I'm sure many of those people were told the Indians did it, so we might as well use it. I don't know that people knew what had happened. I think there was a lot of lying from the very beginning. But those are facts. And the story that I tell in Red Water of a child recognizing months after the massacre, Emily is wearing a dress at a picnic, and a child, one of the survivors, there were 17 children, as most of you know, who survived the massacre, who they let live because they were under the age of 8. And they were taken back to Mormon homes, and one of those children walked up to Emily and said, "That's my mother's dress. Where's my mother?" and started crying. "That's my mother's dress." I believe that actually happened because it was reported in several places that happened. And all I can say is that reading this book gave me an appreciation for the incredible poverty then and the incredible gluttony now. We have so many belongings now that we can hardly stuff another sweater into the drawer. And it's astonishing to think that in 150 years, we have this almost a claustrophobia of possessions. They began to weight us down and make us crazy. We have so much. And then they had absolutely nothing. And I think that wagon train was attacked for a variety of reasons. And one of them, I think it was revenge, and I think it was fear. and I think it was war booty. I think that, you know, they were preparing for war with the United States, and that was a rich wagon train, and it would help them, you know, get goods. Yes?
Did you have any reaction to the date of the terror?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, again, I was alone in Idaho on September 11th when the terrorists attacked the World Trade Center, horrified and frightened at being apart from my husband. And then I sat down in the evening, and it just came to me. I thought, wait a minute, wasn't that the date of the massacre, September 11th? And then I realized it was. It's just a coincidence. But I don't try and draw parallels between those two things, because I think they're quite different. But I think, as I've suggested, there are certain components that are the same, that are worth thinking about. Yeah.
I was wondering, how did you come to write the lesbian scene?
First of all, I would never call it a lesbian scene. And I'm surprised you would. He's referring to a scene in the novel where Emma and Anne are sister wives and they climb in the same bed that night, and it's left a little vague exactly what happens. But I wrote that because I had ample evidence that they were incredibly fond of each other, and because I felt that it wasn't out of the realm of possibility, not necessarily for those two specific individuals, but that polygamy itself must have engendered sexual crossovers in some way, and certainly a lot of sexual activity. But a reporter from the Deseret News called me, and she said, "Does this mean you think that they were lesbians?" And I said, "Don't even use that word. Don't even think that word." Because I think women often have very affectionate physical relationships. They're not always reported, but they happen. And I think they happened then, too. And I think they happened within these pluralistic households. It was a license that I took in the end, and that's the only answer. But I felt like it wasn't beyond the realm of possibility.
How did you go about the research of the three wives? What information did you find? What sources were available in order to create either a historical fiction or a fictional history?
The most important source I had was the diaries of John D. Lee, and they're about to be republished by the Huntington Library. They were edited and transcribed by Juanita Brooks, I think in the 1970s, I'm not sure. There are two volumes. They're called A Mormon Chronicle, The Diaries of John D. Lee. They are some of the most remarkable frontier documents that we have. And in those diaries, he talks about everything, daily life, having to do with his family, his children, his wives. They were really extraordinarily rich documents. They were really important for me.
Kids needed to know this information. And so for two class periods, Juanita Brooks told her story. I thought it was an amazing thing.
I think he missed
back to this question,
conversation that I had.
Mm-hmm. Back to this question about the research of these women. In my reading of those, and it's been some years ago, I didn't think there was a plethora of information about
Well, as I said, I used Anne Gorge Lee's memoir, and that's a lengthy memoir in TypeScript form that really is a first-person voice talking about her feelings about living in that polygamous household, the other wives, daily life, certain events, details, John D. Lee. So that was a rich source of information. Rachel Lee also left, not exactly a diary, but she kept the minutes for the church in Harmony, Fort Harmony, in the mid-1850s. And I was able to look at the original of that in the Huntington Library, and even though it's a rather dry document, Brother Lee said this and Brother Lee said that in church, it also has remarkable little tidbits of information about the buying of Indian children, for instance. How many Indian children were bought that week? By which families and which ones lived long enough to be named and blessed. So here was another original source document by one of the women that I'd chosen to make a narrator in her voice, first person, a diary of sorts. And then the biography of Emma Lee by Juanita Brooks was really helpful for Emma. Yeah, I think, you know, John D. Lee, he was reinstated into the church in 1971. I think even the church authorities realized that they could no longer pin it on John D. Lee, and his descendants really worked very hard to have his name cleared. Brigham Young adopted him as his spiritual son. For me, the story was almost Shakespearean, because in the end, Brigham Young abandoned him and sacrificed him. There's no question about it. So there are complex feelings, I'm sure, about Brigham Young, about John D. Lee. It's a discussion that's going to go on. I mean, it's astonishing, when I started this book in 1996, it didn't seem like a lot of people were thinking about Mountain Meadows, but it took me so long to write it that by the time it came out, there are a lot of other things coming out about Mountain Meadows. It's a subject that the church must continue to deal with. They're dealing with it still in a certain kind of way, still stonewalling in a way. They have the right to do that. They're bringing out their own definitive history, supposedly next year or the year after. So it's a discussion that will continue to go on. I don't know, I think we're over time, unfortunately. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. I see John walked in. Vulnerable, really. Vulnerable, weak. Yeah. Thank you.
Of course, I remember. I saw you. Nobody I was quite sure that was you. I thought I'd read you.
But it was wonderful. And your book was great. Thank you.
Thank you. So nice to see you again.
You live on the church.
I know. I did get a letter from her calling me to a hearing, but I was not busy. No. They wanted me to explain my religious views so they could decide what should be done about them. And I didn't think anything needed to be done about them.
No, you don't know them.
So I just have not responded.